This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Dave Packer. The death toll has risen to no fewer than 14 after severe storms plowed through Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas today. In Valley View, Texas, one man was out searching at the site of the repair shop where he left his RV to be repaired before the tornado struck.
They had a line of RVs for repairs, and that whole line is just gone.
In Indianapolis, engines running, but no racing yet. Thunderstorms delayed today's Indy 500. Officials are hoping to get underway around 4:30 this afternoon. Four girls between the ages of 9 and 17 recovering after being randomly stabbed in a suburban Boston movie theater. The suspect in custody and may be linked to two stabbings at a McDonald's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and a homicide in Connecticut. Libertarian Party delegates at their Washington, D.C. convention are voting now to select their 2024 presidential nominee. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one of the 10 options on the ballot. This is ABC News. There were sirens in Tel Aviv today as the city came under a Hamas rocket attack. Those rockets launched from the Rafah area, says Israel Defense Forces. There were minor injuries. Plane crash in Northern Carolina's Cumberland County, leaving three people injured today. The Piper Warrior single-engine plane came down in a heavily wooded area, one person with serious injuries. PGA golfer Grayson Murray died by suicide. That from his family today after his death was announced Saturday. Murray withdrew Friday from a tournament in Fort Worth, Texas, citing an illness. Murray was just 30 years old. An Oakland, California teen who applied to more than 150 colleges has been accepted at 122 of them and collected more than $5 million in grants and scholarship offers. Helms Aigeta was a 3.94 grade point average at Head Royce High School.
I sort of wanted to prove to myself that that is something I'm really passionate about and I'm willing to make come true.
Dave Packer, ABC News.
And here's Heather with the weather.
Well, it's beautiful out there, sunny and 75, almost a little chilly in the shade. Now, let's get a read on the inside of your car. It is hot. You've only been parked a short time and it's already 99 degrees in there. Let's not leave children in the back seat while running errands. It only takes a few minutes for their body temperatures to rise, and that could be fatal.
Cars get hot fast and can be deadly. Never leave a child in a car. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the punch bowl? Where's the toilet bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
4 Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Avian flu is jumping from birds to dairy cattle around the country. So far, it's not turned up in Wisconsin, but experts are being vigilant. Mike Moan has more.
Bird flu has been detected in dairy cows in several other states. And in Texas, a man is known to have become ill with bird flu last month after contact with infected dairy cattle. And that worries Andrew Pecos with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Given that dairy farms have a large number of people who can come in contact with infected cows, there is an increased chance of the H5N1 virus also directly infecting humans and beginning that process of adapting to replication and spread within humans themselves.
He says the risk to the general public is still very low, but the U.S. should improve its response to new and emerging infections to minimize the chance of another pandemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced it will pay dairy farms with confirmed avian flu infections to help contain the virus's spread to people and more cows. In Texas, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the virus killed a dozen cats who drank raw cow's milk. Megan Davis, also with Johns Hopkins, believes it's safe to eat poultry and drink milk, with one exception.
Raw milk and raw milk products may not undergo the same processes to inactivate the virus, and so I have very large concerns about the safety of raw milk.
To date, federal officials only mandate testing for dairy cows moving between states. Wisconsin has long embraced its reputation as a milk-producing state. In most rankings, it only trails California in this category. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Lacrosse weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, slight chance of a shower, then becoming partly cloudy and a low around 50. Showers and thunderstorms for your Memorial Day, otherwise partly sunny with highs around 70 degrees. A few scattered storms Monday night with a low of 53. On Tuesday, mostly sunny, some scattered storms, 68.
Right now, it's 55.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time for a special Memorial Day show as we have on Jeremy Lyon from the Department of Veterans Affairs and looking back at Gold Star families.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, focusing a huge amount appropriately on the conduct, the recent activities, the words, the speech of Associate Justice Sam Alito, plainly in the wake of his flying of these flags that express his view explicitly that he feels that the 2020 election was stolen. Support for those people who advocate for that position, a position that has been rejected roundly, soundly, decisively by every single court that's addressed this, and an associate justice who is right now deciding cases that go to those very issues about the legitimacy of the 2020 election. Two cases coming up for a decision, an awful lot of advocacy there out there for his recusal. Take yourself off those decisions while you have exhibited this bias toward a particular position on the legitimacy of the 2020 election. That's appropriate. That is highly appropriate. It is not enough. And that's the advocacy of this weekend's broadcast. We know that in addition to his apparent contempt for what happened in the 2020 election, his cynicism about the results of that time, he expresses equal cynicism and contempt for things like the fact that fraud is rampant in our system. He writes that in the 2020 decision, in which he says Americans should be concerned about the fraud in our elections and legislatures should craft their responses to that, understanding that fraud exists, and it does not. And there, once again, he expresses to America, through the law of the United States, codified in this case called Brnovich, the notion that we have fraud in our elections and that voting is suspect and that you should not trust the results of what happens. That's number one. What else does he have contempt for and a sense of cynicism about? He's got cynicism about his own Supreme Court. He suggests that the predecessors on the bench 49 years ago, people like Harry Blackmun and indeed Sandra Day O'Connor, when they did a legitimate, obviously controversial, but an analysis of the privacy rights of the Constitution, not only got it wrong, but were doing so in violation of the Constitution. He is suspect of the history of his own institution, even more compelling than that. He is suspect of the very processes that are a part of the court system. He tells us a month ago that he does not trust grand jurors. He does not trust the processes of prosecutors. He doesn't trust any of that, that grand jurors every so often might get it right, but most often they're indicting ham sandwiches. And once again, the grand jury, a system of the courts, not the executive branch, that's him. That's the Supreme Court. And he expresses nothing but contempt and cynicism for that process as well. Every so often, he says they get it right, as often as when an eclipse happens. That is an associate justice of the Supreme Court saying and writing those things in recent years. The question then is whether or not he should continue to serve, given not only his recent obvious statements about the 2020 election, but also these other issues related to cynicism and contempt for the very systems of government for which he is responsible in part and on which he is deciding major issues. That is the question. That is the question before America. Should that person continue to serve on the United States Supreme Court? And for answers to that, hopefully in all directions, I turn to our listeners, our callers. We appreciate, again, views in all directions on what is admittedly a crisis, as at least two members of our Congress have indicated, asking for a meeting with the Chief Justice, asking for recusal, asking for a meeting to talk about all this. Good first step, not enough. Not enough. Let's go to some of our callers who may have reactions to my advocacy for the resignation of Associate Justice Sam Alito from the United States Supreme Court. Let's begin with Kristen. Kristen from Waukesha, thanks so much for being with me this morning. How are you this morning, Kristen?
Hi, Jim. I'm doing great. I am just so thankful that you are taking such a strong position on this. I think the way you laid out all the reasons that he should be recused, or not only should he recuse himself, but he should step down from the court, is the clearest and most comprehensive list that I've seen or heard. And I really hope that the listeners share the podcast of this show with their friends and families and really get that message out there. I fear not only for the current cases of the court, but what happens if, I hope, Trump loses in 2024 and this all comes back again. How could we possibly trust Sam Alito to make any kind of a decision that is unbiased when clearly this is all about Donald Trump? None of the other Republicans brought their cases all over the Supreme Court and said, there was fraud, I should have won. Only Trump. So, yeah, it's unbelievable. I thank you for doing this. I think we all need to do whatever we can to raise this issue until it can't be ignored.
Kristen, I thank you so much, not only for those supportive words, but more importantly, your sense as we digest this together as a community, as a nation. There's actually more out there that I'm not reviewing here on our weekend broadcast, more about what he has written and what he has said that, again, goes far beyond this issue related to flags. It goes beyond all of that and defines who he is. And as you, I believe, have appropriately said this morning, I plainly concur in your view as well. It reflects on someone who is given responsibility for deciding what the law is and who plainly has a contempt, regardless even of the substance of how he resolves these cases, resolves cases involving privacy rights and voting rights. He distrusts the grand jury system. He distrusts prosecutors. He distrusts voting. He distrusts polling. He dismisses and is contemptuous of these basic things at which are a part of our democracy, our republic. And I would offer that they're contrary to the very oath that he has taken to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, the separate oath that he takes as a Supreme Court justice to abide by the law and to bring to his analysis an unbiased and unvarnished view of the facts and to apply the law to the facts as he may find them. We're going to talk more about that when it comes to the case out of South Carolina in just a few moments. Kristen, appreciate very much your thoughts and your advocacy for more of the discussion about this far beyond just flags. Let's talk with other callers this morning. Mark, you're calling in this morning. Mark, glad to have you with me this morning as well on Amicus, a law review.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Jimmy. I'd point out to Sam Alito, both the Fourth Amendment and the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution. The Fourth gives us right to be secure in our persons. And the Ninth Amendment actually says that there are certain rights that the people hold that are not enumerated in the Constitution. And one of those rights would be the right to privacy. I would uphold simply under that language. And as far as abortion goes, abortion was common in the late 18th century and early 19th century America. I mean, it wasn't questioned. Women just happened, and there was no laws banning it. And under the English common law, which is supposed to be is part of the ultimate basis of our law, there's no establishment cause of religion as well. So Sam Alito has relied on Catholic doctrine, you know, quoting, you know, edicts from the Pope with, you know, about colonization is just a sign that he is completely out of touch with what the founders actually intended in our Constitution. They intended on a secular democracy, expanding the rights of people and individuals, you know, to take it, govern themselves. I mean, his Hobbesian view of society that you need a strong hand at government, and we're not supposed to trust what the people want at all, is just, should be anathema to every American.
Right. And so that notion, Mark, of trust that you identify, anathema to Americans, yes, that's exactly the point, right, that you're sharing. And when you discuss all of the issues that are properly before the Supreme Court right now, it's about trusting fundamentally in the institutions and Americans having trust in our Supreme Court. They can have that trust. They should have that trust. I've had that trust throughout my entire life. I suspect you and other callers, listeners, have had that same trust based upon the notion that while we may disagree with them on particular issues across the board, they take up a lot of different things these days. Fundamentally, we know that at the core, they've got the interests of America. We can trust them to be concerned about and focused upon the best interests of America. That's my advocacy this morning, that is no longer the case when it comes to Sam Alito. We can make distinctions with other Supreme Court justices. We may say we disagree, agree with them on those issues. This isn't a Supreme Court justice who has shown contempt for the basic trappings of government, even as he applies those and uses those to come to the results that you're describing. So again, appreciate very much, Mark, your comments and your calling in this morning as well. We have another caller, John, calling in as well. Appreciate your being a part of our discussion this morning. John, your comment or question?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Clearly, Alito, by stating his belief, which is unsubstantiated by any evidence that he should, as a justice, be using for making such a conclusion, by stating his belief that there's reason to distrust the results in our election system, Alito is simply encouraging the distrust of our election system.
Yes. Yeah.
To paraphrase Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda, if you tell the same lie often enough, it becomes true.
Right.
Now, as far as corruption in the court is concerned, as far as I know, there's no constitutional reason for federal judiciary appointments being lifetime. I believe the provision says it's for terms of good behavior. And traditionally, what that's meant is that the only way to get rid of a federal judge of any kind is impeachment.
Right.
But shouldn't there be another way if there are real
right.
checks and balances? I
right.
mean, if the president can appoint them, isn't he the boss?
Right.
Couldn't he theoretically fire them?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that would set up, you know, a constitutional crisis between the administration and the judiciary. But I'd agree it's better, or I'd argue rather, it's better done now than when the obviously corrupt so-called justices continue to ignore the Constitution
right,
itself,
right.
and even ignore legislative laws.
Right. And interesting, John, there is, in addition to the constitutional provision, this good behavior provision that anticipates lifetime tenure, Sheldon Whitehouse, again, signing this letter asking for a meeting. And yes, there should be more than a meeting, right? There should be much more than a meeting. He has also authored some legislation that would establish term limits for justices. Sounds unconstitutional, but his concept is under this legislation, again, getting nowhere in this Congress, is that there would be term limits, 15-year term limits, and after that, we would not strip them of their status, but they move on to sort of an emeritus status, continue perhaps to preside over circuit court cases, do other things, but in the future, that those terms would be limited and provide more accountability, and you could address with respect to present nominees and future nominees, whether or not they are committed to the basic trappings of our nation. We're going to talk more about all of this as our weekend review here on Amicus Law Review continues, and also talk more about Sam Alito and his authoring on behalf of the majority, a major opinion coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today, I'm going to share a practical hack that I use to manage my spending. It's my wish list. A wish list is just a note I keep in my phone where I write down all the things I want to buy, but I don't have a plan or a budget to buy. You know, like stuff I see randomly on Instagram or TikTok, or these new shoes that my BFF just got that I am totally obsessed about. My wish list does two things. First, it gives me a place to put that feeling of want instead of just pulling out my credit card. And second, gives me time to decide if I really want it. And then, if I can afford it. I revisit my wish list once a week or so. I take a look at every single thing on there, and then I pick if I want to find the budget for that thing or if I'm going to, you know, let it go. And I will tell you that mostly I end up letting things go. So if you're looking to cut back on spending, try making a wish list. This is Carrie Joy, and that has been your Work Money Minute. Take good care.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amica Solorovu. We are spending much of our time this weekend talking about Sam Alito. Yes, the flags issues, which revealed his bias when it comes to issues pending before the Supreme Court right now, but also talking about his recent history of contempt for everything from voting in America, subject to fraud regularly, such that he puts it in an opinion of the United States Supreme Court, contempt for the history of his own court, suggesting that predecessors in his position and the positions of others operated unconstitutionally and that their misbehavior, their misconduct has to be remedied now as he did a couple of years ago, focusing most recently upon this notion that somehow prosecutors and grand jurors, arguably even trial jurors, are not appropriate and that they engage in their behaviors in a way that does not accomplish justice, contempt for the basic trappings that he himself is responsible for enforcing, and for that reason advocating here this weekend on our broadcast that there be more than a meeting. Appreciate very much the effort and value and support the meeting concept. More than a meeting, maybe there should also be some testimony before a hearing of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Perhaps let's do something else unprecedented. Let's go ahead and subpoena Supreme Court justices to come across the parking lot there on Capitol Hill and subpoena the Chief Justice to come in and explain what's going on ethically before the Supreme Court. Subpoena Sam Alito to come and explain how, on the one hand, he can fly these flags and articulate these things while at the same time purporting to be unbiased and have a neutral view on these kinds of things. Done before? Nope. Unprecedented. And yet we talk a lot about all the unprecedented things happening. See if the Supreme Court, would accept, number one, the invitation, non-subpoenaed invitation to come and appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee, even the House Judiciary Committee, if they would really be interested in exploring these issues. And if not, seek to enforce those subpoenas in the Federal District Court there in Washington, D.C. See if that would go. See what would happen. If you attempt to enforce a subpoena of a Supreme Court justice in the role, your oversight role, your check and balance role as a co-equal branch, that is the Congress and the Senate of the United States of America. Lots of things that can be done here. A meeting has been invited. We'll see what the Chief Justice, how he responds to that. Probably highly unlikely that meeting is going to take place. No testimony, no subpoena, no recusal, no removal, none of this. And thus the outrage of the American population as we look to a Supreme Court that is deciding right now these major issues and wondering aloud if that Supreme Court, and this is the point, if that Supreme Court is credible. Should we trust the Supreme Court when it expresses this hostility, this cynicism about the basic trappings of our government? Why should we follow those decisions? And we should. That's the rule of law in America. That's kept us animated for 240 years. But why should we do that if indeed the very justices who are telling us what the law is, they themselves are not in support of the basic trappings of our Constitution and our government? That's the question. That's the question that as we head into this election season, all Americans should be asking. That's the question that should focus upon Sam Alito and ask him about what his next step is in the midst of his disbelief in the fundamental structures of our government. Kristen is on the line, and I would take Kristen's call as well. Kristen.
Hi, this is Jean from Eau Claire.
Yes, Kristen. Thanks so much for being with me this weekend.
No, this is Jean. I just want to call and say thank you for this show. I have never seen it laid out so well. You know, in a sense, Alito has proclaimed himself, you know, as the decider-in-chief. He really has, by the proclamation that he has made, lays the groundwork for both psychologically and legally, totally, making one pathway for anybody to utilize the legal system, you know, to protect their rights by, you know, running down the decisions of former justices, I mean, that have been there for years and years. People really need to share your podcast today. It is so amazing, your show today, Jim, because it just lays out, because this is so dangerous, because by totally discrediting, all of the different legal avenues that a person has and totally discrediting them, and then empowering legislatures to take away rights because of the fraud. I mean, thank you, James. He needs to go, and they need to take this seriously, because this was the only avenue for the people to protect their democracy and their rights. So thank you, James. This is unbelievable, and we all need to have our voices heard and say no more, no more, because there will be no more, because he has just proclaimed himself the decider of everything. Thank you very much, James. Appreciate it.
And Jane, I thank you. I appreciate your phone call in here. Again, on this broadcast and other broadcasts of Civic Media, we entertain and value views in all directions, and appreciate when others beyond me not only articulate their views, don't necessarily have to agree with me, but it is good to know that the messages here about this contempt, the cynicism, are falling on ears that are listening and at least giving some critical thinking to all of this. And again, the major question implicit in what your comments are all about, Jane, is what do we do next? What do we do next? It is good, as I said, that there be a meeting of some kind. I don't know how that works. I don't know if that's a public meeting, a private meeting. That's what the leadership of the Judiciary Committee and the Senate have asked for. There needs to be more than that, right, Jane? There needs to be a hearing, a public hearing. The Chief Justice needs to walk across the parking lot and appear before the Judiciary Committee. He needs to explain what's going on, not only with recusals, appropriate recusals. He needs to explain what's going on with this ethics code, which has not been resolved yet. He needs to explain things about the integrity of the court. This is the John Roberts Court. He needs to appear there in that public setting to answer legitimate oversight questions of another branch of government. And if he doesn't do so, the Congress needs to enforce those subpoenas in ways that we have not done before. That is dramatic. That would be stunning to have that happen, but that needs to happen as well as a part of our system to ensure that going forward, not just this generation, future generations have trust in our Supreme Court of this land. Appreciate not only Jane and the other callers, but also people like Dawn Hall, who are also sending me some notes and questions. Appreciate Dawn, your comments and your questions also in this area of what our Supreme Court is doing and the integrity that they necessarily need to bring to their job on a regular basis. Let's talk about something else that Sam Alito has done just this past week, and that is this major decision. Yes, that's right. We're in the midst of this time in the Supreme Court's history when they're issuing major decisions in many cases. A major decision coming out just a couple of days ago, just this past week, May 23rd. The case is Alexander versus South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. Yes, this is this major case that we have talked about before. It is the singular but critically important case on the docket of this Supreme Court in this term, talking all about the intersection between politics and race. And the question here is whether or not the South Carolina legislature, when it redrew what's called District 1 right along the coast in South Carolina there, did it do that for political purposes, which, believe it or not, in America today are proper, or at least not justiciable. Courts cannot review those things. Or did they do this out of a racial animus, in which case courts can review those decisions? Which one of these happened here? The Chief Justice and the other justices in the majority ruled this past week that this was all about politics and this was not about race. And indeed, even though that was the case, the lines there in South Carolina will stay as they are. When we come back, talking more about that case here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. ABC News. I'm Dave Packer. The death toll has risen to no fewer than 14 after severe storms plowed through Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas today. In Valley View, Texas, one man was out searching at the site of the repair shop where he left his RV to be repaired before the tornado struck.
They had a line of RVs for repairs, and that whole line is just gone.
In Indianapolis, engines running, but no racing yet. Thunderstorms delayed today's Indy 500. Officials are hoping to get underway around 4:30 this afternoon. Four girls between the ages of 9 and 17 recovering after being randomly stabbed in a suburban Boston movie theater. The suspect in custody and may be linked to two stabbings at a McDonald's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and a homicide in Connecticut. Libertarian Party delegates at their Washington, D.C. convention are voting now to select their 2024 presidential nominee. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one of the 10 options on the ballot. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
A near no-hitter. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from Fenway Park in Boston, where the Brewers won two games using a different kind of a plan on the mound. Instead of a starter, for two consecutive days, the Brewers led the game with lefty reliever Jared Koenig in the first inning to face the top of the Red Sox batting order that had three of the first four batters left-handed. Then, on Saturday, Colin Ray came in, took it to a no-hitter almost to the seventh inning. What was it like to adjust to that schedule? And will this plan be used more in the future?
Yeah, I think it just depends on the opposing lineup. You know, the last two games worked out pretty good, so it gives us options. It's really just moving that routine back a little bit and not playing catch so early and kind of just feeling the game out, feeling that first inning out, not overdoing it too early.
That's Brewers pitcher Colin Ray. The crew beating the Red Sox 7-2 on Friday, 6-3 on Saturday. Memorial Day, they open up a four-game home series against the Chicago Cubs. From Fenway Park in Boston, with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Lacrosse weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, slight chance of a shower, then becoming partly cloudy and a low around 50. Showers and thunderstorms for your Memorial Day, otherwise partly sunny with highs around 70 degrees. A few scattered storms Monday night with a low of 53. On Tuesday, mostly sunny, some scattered storms, 68.
Right now, it's 55.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is here and ready to help. Anyone can call or text 988 or chat via 988wisconsin.org to get connected to a trained Lifeline counselor. Trained counselors are here to support anyone experiencing a suicidal, mental health, or substance use crisis. You can also contact 988 if you are concerned about someone. 988 is confidential and free to all Wisconsin residents. 988, 24/7. Call, text, chat. Here to support you. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Matt Nair on air.
Dr. Karen Tamarius, she's a political psychiatrist, and we're talking about how to talk to people with which we do not agree.
Think of the mind as a rider on an elephant. The conscious part is the rider, and the emotional part is the elephant. If you want the person to change their mind, you need to talk with the elephant, not the rider.
Matt Nair on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday's Best of Up North News Radio, having to bail our fast-growing lawns and how people who differ on abortion can have civil conversations.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for your continuing listening on our weekend program, talking once again about justice, the rule of law, government in our nation, and focusing now on this major case, one of many cases. Supreme Court's got about 36 more cases to issue between now, presumably, until the 4th of July. Lots and lots of cases coming up here. We're going to be talking about all of them. And this plainly among the most important of those 36. They've already issued opinions in about 26 cases, some of which we have already discussed here on our Civic Media broadcast. This case, Alexander versus South Carolina, NAACP. Question of how a legislature works. The question there is whether or not the South Carolina legislature, in redrawing some maps in the wake of the 2020 census, and indeed in the wake of an election in which it became very clear that a Republican majority was waning in a particular district, the first district, when they redrew these maps, and in particular the maps of the first district and the sixth district as well in South Carolina, did they do that out of racial focus, racial purpose? In which case, that, of course, is unconstitutional. That is subject to review in the federal and even state courts of our land. That, the Supreme Court has said, is justiciable. That's the kind of thing that can be taken up by the Supreme Court. But in another case called Rucco versus Common Cause, way back in 2019, the Supreme Court said, if you do gerrymandering based upon political motivation, you're doing this because of partisan politics, you want to ensure that my particular party, Republican, Democrat, another party, whoever you are, wherever you're affiliated, we want to make certain that we maintain control, that decision, that political decision, that partisan decision is not justiciable. That's the kind of thing that cannot be inside the courts. And the Supreme Court, again, with some controversy, ruled in 2019, they'll take up the racial gerrymandering challenges, but they will not take up the political partisan gerrymandering challenges. And so the question here is, who is right and who is wrong in describing what happened in South Carolina in recent years? The voting case, again, this matter coming before the Supreme Court, and the decision coming out of the Supreme Court is ultimately, as the Supreme Court ruled, that the South Carolina population, the legislature, will keep using a congressional map that the lower courts that looked at all this said, yes, indeed, this is racial gerrymandering. This is not principally partisan gerrymandering. The lower court had deemed this unconstitutional. This is racial animus, a racial gerrymander, the lower court had said. They said it resulted in a bleaching of African-American voters from a certain district. That's District 1. The conservative majority of our Supreme Court, led, yes, that's right, by Sam Alito. He writes the majority opinion on behalf of himself and five others, a 6-3 vote, returns this case to a lower court. There are more proceedings are going on, but plainly decides that indeed what has happened here is okay, allowing the South Carolina Republicans, the legislature there, to maintain boundaries that helped make this district in question a party stronghold, basically saying, yes, you can do this. And that's because we have determined, based upon our review of the facts, that this is not racially motivated. This is simply partisan politics. Now, lots and lots of things to unpack here. It is an extensive opinion, almost 40 pages. The majority opinion, again, written by Sam Alito. We've got a very interesting concurrence and quasi-dissent written by Justice Clarence Thomas, in which he suggests that maybe the 1954 decision in Brown and Brown 2, maybe too much enforcement going on there. Stunning coming out of any Supreme Court justice, but again, suggesting that he himself is not committed to the precedents of the Supreme Court. And then a very, very compelling, a very readable, a very digestible dissent, a scathing dissent. From Elena Kagan, joined in by Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor, in which she basically says this: what the Supreme Court has done in its majority is to substitute its own views about the evidence for that of the lower court that had a trial that entertained witnesses and documents. And that gets to the fundamental notion that she articulates, which is under a clear error analysis, what the lower court determined, which is that there was, in fact, a racial gerrymander here, moving large populations around
in a way that disenfranchised black voters in South Carolina. That was the determination of the lower court based upon its in-court, its careful analysis, and at the appellate level, Supreme Court or other courts at the appellate level apply what's called a clear error standard, So a little bit of civics, a little bit of law school here, as we often do on this broadcast. The standard of review that appellate courts, including the Supreme Court, usually undertake when reviewing a trial court's findings of fact, that's called clear error. And it means just what it says. A review under this clearly erroneous standard is very deferential. We only overturn that as an appellate court if the decision on the facts is clearly, unmistakably in error. If the trial court's factual determinations are plausible, which is exactly what Elena Kagan says repeatedly as she goes through all of the evidence here, if it's plausible in light of the record as a whole, the appellate courts in our country, including the Supreme Court, may not reverse, even if the appellate court would have decided things differently. Even if the individual justices, even those on a panel of an appellate court, say, you know what, I might have viewed this differently, but we defer, there's that word once again, we defer to the lower court because they were there. They listened to the witnesses. They assessed credibility. They did all those kinds of things. And under the clear error standard, we should defer to those findings unless, once again, it is so absolutely ridiculous in terms of the factual findings that it cannot hold. When reviewing mixed questions of law and fact, that's when appellate courts use a clear error standard of review. When the lower court's decision primarily focuses on factual work, and a de novo standard of review when that decision involves primarily legal analysis. We review things de novo under that definition when indeed there's a mixed question of law and fact, and you've got to review the law, what the law says, not when the facts have to be reassessed. And that's what Elena Kagan says principally in her dissent, which is scathing on behalf of herself and two others. She identifies once again that the parties agree that the South Carolina legislature wanted to make District 1 more Republican. Nobody disagrees about that. They further agree, she says, that in pursuit of that aim, the legislature moved nearly 200,000 people into or out of that district. What the parties disagree about, she writes, is how the people expelled from the district were chosen. The state, that is the legislature, she says, contends that its map maker looked exclusively at data, only at data, from the last election and targeted people who had voted Democratic. In other words, only look at partisan considerations. If that is true, Elena Kagan and even the others in the court say, the state's action, however unsavory and undemocratic, that's Elena Kagan saying, you may not like it, but that's the law today under this RUCO case of a number of years ago. Even if you don't like it, it's immune from federal constitutional challenge, and therefore, we've got no case here. The challengers, that is the people who object to the way that this District 1 was restyled and remapped, that basically moved large black populations and large white populations around, was in fact done for racial purposes to diminish the impact of the black vote on racial grounds there in South Carolina. The challengers, she said, offer a very different account. They say that the mapmakers, not content with what the election data revealed, also reviewed and heavily relied on racial data, thus exploiting the well-known correlation between race and voting behavior. And if that is true, as Elena Kagan sets forth the understanding here, the challengers have a good constitutional claim because, and here we go, the Equal Protection Clause forbids basing election districts mainly on race in order to achieve partisan aims. And so the question is, what do we have going on here? What Sam Alito says in the majority is that we have here overwhelmingly, contrary to what the lower court said, what we've got here is partisan gerrymandering. That's okay. And so we keep our hands off. We're sending this back down for the lower court to address this pursuant to that finding. And in fact, there is no sort of entangling, if you will, of race and partisan politics here. The majority, written by Sam Alito, in this key ruling says they, the challengers, provided no direct evidence of a racial gerrymander, and their circumstantial evidence, which again can be just as compelling as direct evidence, that's me talking, not Justice Alito, Their circumstantial evidence, he says, is very weak. Instead, the challengers relied on deeply flawed expert reports, again, indicating that he's going beyond a clear error standard. We're going into a de novo review, if you will, of the facts, not the law, the facts. Flawed expert reports. And indeed, he spends a lot of the opinion analyzing the four or so expert reports here and saying, explaining why it is they're all wrong. And while those experts produced tens of thousands of maps with differently configured districts, he says, they did not offer a single map that achieved the legislature's partisan goal while including a higher map in District 1. In particular, makes reference to this District 1 as being problematic there. Faced with this record, we must reverse the district court. Even in our clear error standards on the racial gerrymandering claim. And he says, we're going to talk about this in four parts. And it also underscores the very way in which he abandons this clear error analysis and said, we're going to put ourselves in the position of being the trial court once again. We're going to set forth the appropriate legal standards, which, yes, indeed, does provide an awful lot of deference to the legislature. That's where you start out, and Elena Kagan and the others do not disagree with that. But second, he says, we're going to explain why the district court's factual findings are clearly flawed. Clearly flawed, he said, with respect to the circumstantial evidence. We're going to examine, he said, the four experts that the challengers presented. And finally, we're going to explain the district court erred by not drawing an adverse inference from the failure to submit an alternative map. And Elena Kagan and her dissent goes after that as well. She says, we're making things up now. The failure of challengers to say, here's an alternative map in a basic foundational contest to whether or not the line drawing is proper or not, all of that, a part of Elena Kagan's strong, strong dissent. In the end, writing on behalf of a majority of the Supreme Court, Justice Samuel Alito, on whom we're focusing, and to whom, in many ways, we're dedicating our weekend show, this broadcast. Sam Alito finding in again here in this major case that there's no violation of the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, no racial animus, no racial animation for doing what the legislature did. Why? Because what they did was all political, and that we will permit. That we will not review. In this case, it's all political, and therefore we never even get, if you will, to the racial issue, which may have been there, but saying that the challengers, the petitioners, the plaintiffs below, in the trial that was presented to a trial court judge who made just the opposite finding, this finding that indeed those votes have been whitewashed there in South Carolina, we're going to substitute our view of this evidence for the view of the district court and indeed of the lower court generally. That's what the majority of the Supreme Court has said in this major opinion. It is worth reading, is worth reviewing. Always advocate for that. Always advocate spending some time, even though it's a lot, especially on a Memorial Day weekend when we honor and we think of with reverence about the sacrifices made for the very institutions that are the subject of this lawsuit and of this decision. Even in Memorial Day weekend, would be good to pull this major opinion out and review it and make a determination on your own about whether or not the majority opinion that rejects the fundamental notions adopted by the lower court that racial motivation was a part of this and that people of color in South Carolina have been disenfranchised by virtue of the way that this District 1 and arguably District 6 was constituted, whether all of that makes sense to you. That should also be a part of your analysis on this Memorial Day weekend, as should a concurring sort of dissenting opinion that's also written by Clarence Thomas. And again, a lot of focus here as well. Clarence Thomas basically says, I would not even get into the analysis because, number one, the Supreme Court, courts generally, not only should we not be focusing upon this distinction between racial animus and racial motivation and political motivation, we shouldn't be doing this at all because we just can't do this. We can't do this at all. He advocates for a new standard that says that the Supreme Court and other courts should be out of this business entirely. He's not a majority on that. But along the way, he also does something else. And that is he takes on, yes, that's right, Brown versus Board of Education. We will talk about what this justice of the Supreme Court said when we come back right here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
One of the most prolific columnists in the Midwest. Mr. James Causey, one of your columns, you mentioned that you got into the news because of the news quiz.
Yes. I would like to be the first person picked. And so.
Yes. Getting picked first for the news quiz teams.
We need to bring that back, actually. I need to talk to my paper about bringing that back.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl. The Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to the Talk of Lacrosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Olorovia. My name is Jim Santel. Continuing our review, necessarily superficial because there's a lot to consume here, of this major decision just this past week by the Supreme Court finding that the decision by the legislature there in South Carolina to redraw the map with respect to District 1, disenfranchising some significant populations, voting populations of color, is permissible, sending the case back down with instructions that there is no problem here. The Supreme Court finding that by a 6-3 majority along the way, that 6 includes Clarence Thomas, and he decides not only should this case be sent back with an approval stamp on it, but beyond that, that the Supreme Court and other courts should be out of this practice entirely, should not be involved in racial versus partisan gerrymandering analysis along the way. And what he says is also stunning. This is, of course, the Supreme Court justice who, not too long ago, in that Dobbs decision that we talked about earlier in this broadcast, also suggested that privacy rights should be back on the table when it comes to same-sex marriage and contraception. Let's revisit that as well. Now, just this past week, Clarence Thomas also says, oh, by the way, we should revisit the enforcement mechanisms in the wake of Brown 2, 1954, 1955, and years going forward. He says that at that time, Brown versus Board of Education finding, of course, that separate schools, separate entities are inherently unequal and they accomplish racial discrimination that our Constitution will not permit. He goes on to say this in his concurring opinion. He says, the court there took a boundless view of equitable remedies, describing equities as being characterized by a practical flexibility in shaping its remedies and by a facility for adjusting and reconciling public and private needs. Now that may be inscrutable, but what he says next is not. He says that understanding, again, talking about Brown versus Board of Education and putting into place, may have justified temporary measures to overcome the widespread resistance to the dictates of the Constitution prevalent at that time. But, and again, this is Clarence Thomas, as a general matter, such extravagant uses of judicial power are at odds with the history and tradition of the powers and the framers' designs. He's basically saying that the enforcement of Brown versus Education was too broad, over the top, shouldn't be happening, extravagant use of judicial power, and recommending that perhaps we should go back, like he recommended in Dobbs, to revisit the issues related to privacy rights in the areas of contraception, same-sex relationships, same-sex marriage. Let's go back and revisit Brown versus Board of Education too, or at least the mechanisms of it that went way too far. Stunning, stunning for a Supreme Court justice to say that. Not the law of the land, thankfully, because this is in a concurrence, a bit of a dissent as well. But along the way, describing his own disagreement with the majority with respect to the breadth of their non-clear error analysis, but also saying that maybe we should go back along the way and look at Brown versus Board of Education too. In the end, I commend to your reading all of this. And I commend as well the reading of the opposing, the dissenting position articulated by Elena Kagan. It is compelling. And page after page explaining why it is that the Supreme Court has set itself up
as a trial court. What she says in the end is this. Basically, go right ahead. She says, what a message to send to state legislatures and mapmakers about racial gerrymandering. For reasons I've addressed in the previous pages of her compelling dissent, those actors will often have an incentive to use race as a proxy to achieve partisan ends. And there it is, the proxy argument. And occasionally, they might want to straight up suppress the electoral influence of minority voters. And then she goes on. This is Elena Kagan writing. Go right ahead, this court says to states today. Go ahead. Though you have no recognized justification for using race, such as to comply with statutes ensuring equal voting rights. Go ahead, though you are, at best, using race as a shortcut to bring about partisan gains, to elect more Republicans in one case, more Democrats in another. It will be easy enough to cover your tracks in the end. Just raise a possibility of non-race-based decision-making, and it will be dispositive, according to the standards articulated by the majority. And this odious practice of sorting citizens built on racial generalizations and exploiting racial divisions will continue. That's what Elena Kagan said. In the electoral sphere, especially where ugly patterns of pervasive racial discrimination have so long governed, we should demand better. That's saying the nation, our nation should demand better of ourselves, of our political representatives, and most of all, of this court. Respectfully, Elena Kagan says on her behalf and that of two others, I dissent. All of that commending to you this Memorial Day weekend for your reading and your digesting. It is a major case. It is one of 36 more that are going to be coming up in the weeks just ahead between now and when we celebrate the next major holiday in our national history, and that is, of course, our Independence Day on the 4th of July. This weekend, we memorialize, we commemorate the deaths, the losses, the sacrifices made by soldiers throughout our nation's history. Throughout our nation's history, who committed their lives, laid down their lives for the principles that I would offer Elena Kagan is identifying today. The notion that voting is important, that voting is meaningful, that we do not have fraud in our votes, at least now in the early part of the 21st century, that our systems of government are right and accurate and they're worth defending. And yes, with respect to those people who laid down their lives, they're worth dying for. That's how important these things are. That our Supreme Court should be a body, a tribunal that understands that, embraces that. And then when it comes to voting rights and all those other things, incredibly important issues for all of us to understand and embrace. And that applies not only to the Supreme Court justices, but to all of us as well. And that includes, in our final minutes here, our callers calling in. Tony calling in. Tony, appreciate your comment as we begin to conclude our weekend broadcast. Your thought or comment today?
Well, I just had a question. I was listening to another show earlier this week with Glenn Kirshner.
Yes.
Another.
Former assistant U.S. attorney, just like me. Yes, exactly.
Yes. And he mentioned a site where you could write to the Supreme Court justices.
Sure. And you know what, Tony,
and
appreciate absolutely. So what we're going to do is we're going to put that sort of on the Civic Media website here. I'll tell you all about that. I'll give you a couple of options, not right now on the air, but we'll also give those to you directly. And we're going to talk more about what you do in the wake of all of this in our broadcast of next week as well, as we talk about how we respond, not only to the decision here coming out of the Supreme Court in South Carolina, but also talking about these larger issues. We'll get that information to you so that you can be a part of our process, which is also America, which is what we celebrate, this institution of our United States. I thank you so much for joining me this weekend. Look forward to your continuing involvement discussion in our future broadcasts right here on Amicus Law Review broadcast stations.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Maggie Dawn.
Hey, everybody. It's Maggie Dawn here. Have a wonderful and safe Memorial Day weekend.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
My doctor told me my cholesterol is borderline, so I took control with Garlic Healthy Cholesterol Formula. Garlic helps maintain healthy cholesterol safely and naturally. It's odor and taste-free, and garlic is a world leader in garlic potency. I'm taking charge of my cholesterol with Garlic Healthy Cholesterol Formula. cholesterol's natural enemy.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The term natural references only the garlic in the product. Use as directed.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.